So the first reading is taken from Acts 4, verses 5 to 12, and can be found on page 1095 of the Pew Bibles. The next day the rulers, elders, and teachers of the law met in Jerusalem. Annas the high priest was there, and so were Caiaphas, John, Alexander, and the other men of the high priest's family. They had Peter and John brought before them and began to question them. By what power or what name did you do this? Then Peter, filled with the Holy Spirit, said to them, Rulers and elders of the people, if we are being called to account today for an act of kindness shown to a cripple and are asked how he was healed, then know this. You and all the people of Israel, it is by the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom you crucified, but whom God raised from the dead, that this man stands before you healed. He is the stone you builders rejected, which has become the capstone. Salvation is found in no one else. For there is no other name under heaven given to men by which we must be saved. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
And now John's going to bring us the...
Our second reading is from Luke 24, verses 25 to 32. And you'll find that on page 1062 in the Bible in front of you. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the woman had said, but they did not see. He said to them, How foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus actively was getting further. But they urged him strongly, Stay with us, for it is nearly evening. The day is almost over. So they went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. And he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, Were not our hearts burning within us? While he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us. This is the word of the Lord.
So let us just pray using the words of Psalm 19. May these words of my mouth and this meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer. So, we have before us this morning one of the most vivid and insightful accounts of Jesus' appearance after his resurrection. Luke is the only one of the four gospel writers to include this story. It's a story that reveals to us not only something about who Jesus was, but also something about who we are, how Jesus can open our eyes to see him for who he is, and how we can come to know him more. The journey to Emmaus is both a literal and a spiritual journey. On one hand, it recounts the story of two disciples who, after the crucifixion and resurrection of our Lord, walk 7 miles from Jerusalem to their village of Emmaus. Actually, of course, they didn't have miles. They had Roman miles. If you're interested, there is We take the next slide, please. Thank you. The distance actually from Jerusalem to Emmaus was 60 stades. And if you see on the slide there, how they used to work things out was in paces. And one pace, well, you normally use one step, but actually in those days, they took one pace to mean two steps. And one stade was 125 paces. 1,000 paces equals a Roman mile. So 8 stades, 1 Roman mile, 60 divided by 8, you get your 7.5 miles. The Roman mile and the English mile, the English mile is just slightly different, slightly longer. Okay, but it's not that different. Now, note how Luke, the gospel writer, the doctor, the scientist, he puts his facts like that in the distance, the 7 miles. He was always concerned with facts, which of course makes his gospel even more believable. Remember the opening words of Luke's gospel. If you could just go back, please. And you see in red there, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning. He was a scientist. He looked at things factually. And he went back and he checked his facts. And I think it makes the gospel even more believable because of that. Anyway, as I was saying, the literal story is about the two disciples on the road from Jerusalem to Emmaus. It's what we would describe as a road trip. Not in a car, but walking. Actually, in a sense, the entirety of Luke's gospel and the book of Acts, which you know he wrote too, is like a road trip. It follows the band of disciples as they journey from their hometown in Galilee to Jerusalem and beyond. Luke's road to Emmaus story follows Cleopas and his unnamed companion as they abandon their fellow disciples in Jerusalem and head for Emmaus. And then after meeting Jesus, return to rejoin them in Jerusalem. That's the literal journey. But of course, the literal journey becomes something completely different when they meet Jesus. It becomes a spiritual journey and a life-changing moment when they realize that they had met with the risen Christ. Of course, we too are also on a spiritual road trip, a spiritual journey through our life. You being here today is just part of that journey. Take a moment to think back to your first encounters with Christ. Was it through a church, perhaps a Sunday school or Sunday club like we have here? Was it through a special person at the church, the chaplain or youth leader? Perhaps a friend led you to faith. I remember personally, my first encounter with Christ was through the church in Hove that we attended, the Church of the Good Shepherd. There it is there. That's me in the middle, front row. As you can see, I had a very conventional Christian upbringing, Sunday school, choir, cubs, the whole thing. But I'm not sure that it really meant a great deal to me. At the time, I just went through the process. But one summer, our church joined with another church in Hove called Bishop Hannington to go on a sailing holiday to the Norfolk Broads. There's Bishop Hannington. Now, some of you may remember Ian Barclay. Hands up who remembers Ian Barclay. Oh, quite a lot of you, okay. Now, he worshipped at Bishop Hannington Church there for many years. And if you remember, he worshipped, he was the chaplain here, for those who didn't know him, between 1998 and 2002. And did you know that he was also a cartoonist? I thought this cartoon might be quite appropriate today. But anyway, perhaps some of you here were helped on your spiritual journey by Ian Barclay, perhaps by his sermons, he was a great preacher, or perhaps also by Riviera Radio. Remember, he had a slot on Riviera Radio every Sunday, I think it was. Anyway, the person who changed my view of Christianity was a young curate called Fred Preston, who I met on that sailing holiday, which our church did then. Fred Preston was the curate at Bishop Hannington. Now, Fred was a seriously tough guy. He was an ex-barrow boy at Covent Garden. You know, Covent Garden was a vegetable garden once upon a time, a vegetable market. And he was one of the guys pushing the barrows full of vegetables around. He was kicked out of Covent Garden for excessive swearing. Now, if you can imagine that, you'd imagine most of those barrow boys used the wrong words almost every other word. But he was kicked out for excessive swearing. Anyway, then he joined the paratroopers. And one day on a parachute jump, his parachute failed to open. And miraculously, he didn't die. And as he felt his life had been saved by God, he decided to do something special for God and returned. He changed his life completely and became a chaplain, an army chaplain. And I managed to find on the net a picture of him preaching to the troops in Aden. And so he remained an army chaplain for many years. And I thought to myself, if a guy like that, that tough guy, could turn to Christianity, then there really must be something in it. Funnily enough, Fred became an ICS chaplain too. He worked in Holland. He became this chaplain for the east of the Netherlands. Anyway, back to the text. On that same day, the same day, of course, is what we now refer to as Easter Sunday, the day of Jesus' resurrection. Two of them, it doesn't say here who they are, but in other translations, it's usually translated as disciples or followers of Jesus. So two followers of Jesus were walking along. Now, who were these two followers of Jesus? Well, we know from later in the text that one of them was named Cleopas, but not the name of the other one. Why is one name remembered and not the other one? Now, we know that Cleopas and his friend weren't part of the original disciples, but we don't know whether they were close to the 12, but we presume so, because after this experience on the road to Emmaus, they go rushing back to tell the disciples, and they knew where they were. Actually, there seems to be a very good reason why Cleopas's name is remembered. Perhaps you recall that someone called Clopas is mentioned in John. Near the cross of Jesus stood his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. Now, many scholars, the Catholic Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, they believe that not only Cleopas is the same person as Clopas, but furthermore, that Cleopas was actually the brother of Joseph, the father, earthly father of Jesus. So in other words, he was Jesus' uncle. So this Mary, the wife of Clopas, would have been the sister-in-law of Mary, the mother of Jesus. She was close family. And so there seems to be every good reason why she was standing there at the foot of the cross with the other Marys. So if indeed Cleopas and Clopas were the same person, then it does seem highly likely that Cleopas was the brother of Joseph and uncle of Jesus. Thank you, Nadia. An angel. Thank you. Furthermore, there's, as you can read there, there's historical justification for believing that this is, as one of the earliest Christian writers, Hegesippus, who wrote about AD 180, he had interviewed the grandsons of Jude the Apostle and learned that Clopas was the brother of Joseph, husband of the Virgin Mary. So we even have historical backing for that. And seems a very good reason why Cleopas's name is remembered if the two are the same. And it would explain in a way why Jesus chose on that day of his resurrection to spend a lot of time with these two disciples rather than any others from the inner group of disciples. Anyway, we don't know for sure, but let's think for a moment if there are any other reasons why Jesus chose to reveal himself to Cleopas and his friend rather than the other disciples. Well, one reason might be that the two disciples were heading in the wrong direction. They were leaving Jerusalem and the other disciples. Were they disillusioned? Had they lost faith? Were they feeling totally lost? Well, early on in Luke's Gospel in chapter 15, Jesus illustrated what might describe his passion for the lost through three memorable stories. The first was the shepherd who has 100 sheep. He loses one and leaves the 99 in the wilderness while he searches for the one that's lost, and then brings it home rejoicing, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep," and throws a party. The second was about a woman who has 10 silver coins and loses one. She lights a lamp and searches the whole house until she finds the lost coin. When it is found, she too calls together friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I had lost." And the third story is about the prodigal son. Father has two sons, one of whom claims his inheritance, leaves home, and wastes all his money on riotous living. The father effectively loses one son, but stays at home, watching and waiting for his return. When the son comes home, he celebrates with a party and with much rejoicing. "For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So we see from these three stories that Jesus cared passionately for the lost ones. When a Christian loses his or her way in life, Jesus is saying, heaven rejoices when they return to faith. Cleopas and his friends were also surely feeling lost. Their guide, their spiritual leader, had been crucified, and they had so many unanswered questions and no one to answer them. Was this why Jesus took all this trouble to spend time with them? Well, it would make sense. So back to this text again. The two friends are walking along the road to Emmaus. We know they were sad because it says their faces were downcast. That's how we are when we're sad. It's a natural reaction to have your face looking downwards. So why are they sad? Well, first, they've just experienced the crucifixion of Jesus. His body has disappeared. And their dreams of Israel being led by the Messiah into a new golden age have been shattered. good enough reasons for feeling sad. Jesus joins them on the road, and he asks them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" Well, they're very surprised that he should be asking that question, because there was only one topic of conversation that Jerusalem would all be discussing at this moment. So they tell him the story of Jesus' betrayal and death and explain, "But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel." So what does this phrase "redeem Israel" mean? In simple terms, to redeem means to buy back something that once was owned. Now here the disciples are referring to their hope that the Messiah would buy back their freedom. Now most Jews understood this as the Messiah freeing them from their oppressors, the Romans, through violent means, a rebellion against the Romans after the pattern, perhaps after the successful Maccabean revolt in the 2nd century BC. But would the followers of Jesus really have imagined that their master was planning to start an insurrection in the manner of Barabbas or the Maccabean revolt? I think it most unlikely. Almost certainly, Cleopas and the other followers of Jesus had witnessed Jesus arriving on what we now call Palm Sunday, a week before the resurrection. The large crowd had acclaimed him as the King who comes in the name of the Lord as they approached Jerusalem. This is a dramatic, carefully staged reenactment of Zechariah's prophecy of the arrival in Zion of Israel's king, riding a beast of burden, righteous and having salvation. I would have thought it much more likely that the larger group of followers believed they were genuinely celebrating the arrival of a peaceful king whose authority and status as a son of David would soon, in the coming weeks and months, be acknowledged by the leadership and the people. Surely they were hoping that the strength of Jesus' teaching, his wisdom, his prophetic insight, the signs and wonders which he performed, the exercise of justice, the sheer force of character, would win the city over. Surely they were hoping it would essentially be a bloodless coup. But of course, it didn't happen. For Jesus, redeeming Israel meant not freedom from the Romans, but paying the ultimate price to free everyone from sin. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? But Cleopas and the other disciples hadn't understood this. All their hopes were crushed when they saw the crucifixion for themselves. They probably thought, he can't have been the real Son of God. If he had been, he would have saved himself. He would have miraculously come down from the cross. It didn't happen. Instead, he suffered the extreme pain and agony of the crucifixion, just like a common criminal. Note how Cleopas and his friend talk about Jesus when they describe him, not as the Son of God, not as the Messiah, but as a prophet. Just one in a long line of prophets that the authorities had killed over the centuries. Even though Jesus has told his followers many times that he would die but rise again, even though they now knew that Jesus' body was no longer in the tomb, even though angels had miraculously appeared and told the people at the tomb that Jesus is still alive, still they were sad. Still they doubted. Ironically, this is a literal fulfillment of something Jesus had said earlier in Luke when he was telling the story about the rich man who goes to hell and the poor beggar who goes to heaven. He said, if they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be persuaded if someone rises from the dead. So Jesus starts talking to the disciples. And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Note how Jesus starts with Moses. This echoes what John had said, Jesus had said when he was being attacked by the religious authorities. For if you believe Jesus, you would believe me, because he wrote about me. Jesus had to go back to basics with Cleopas and his friend. What a change this was from the earliest encounters of the disciples with Jesus. Do you remember how Philip recognized Jesus as the Messiah immediately and rushed to tell Nathanael? Philip found Nathanael and told him, we have found the one Moses wrote about in the law, and so did the prophets, Jesus, the son of Joseph from Nazareth. So Jesus starts talking to them and explaining the scriptures. Well, we don't know the specific messages and passages that Jesus used. Afterwards, it's been reckoned there are some 300 passages in the Old Testament that can be seen as referring to Jesus. So he had a lot to choose from. We do know he quoted the scriptures, and so Jesus wanted them to see that if they would only believe what the scriptures said about him, they would understand why he came and why he had to suffer on the cross. Perhaps Jesus began with Moses' own words in Deuteronomy. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own brothers. You must listen to him. And from there, at some stage, might have gone on to quote Isaiah. God says, therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive, have a son, and name him Emmanuel. Jesus probably included the picture of the suffering servant in Isaiah 53. It wasn't the all-conquering military king that many Jews were hoping the Messiah would be. No, he was despised and rejected by men. A man of suffering who knew what sickness was. He was like one people turned away from. He was despised and did not value him. Perhaps Jesus showed them what Isaiah said in 53:7. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb led to the slaughter, and like a sheep silent before his shearers, he did not open his mouth. And then they probably went on to explain why Jesus didn't bother to defend himself in front of Pilate and the Sanhedrin. Maybe Jesus finished by quoting Zechariah. Then I will pour out a spirit of grace and prayer on the house of David and the residents of Jerusalem, and they will look at me whom they pierced. They will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child, and weep bitterly for him as one mourns as one weeps for a firstborn. This surely echoed what not just Cleopas and his friend must have felt, but all the disciples must have felt after witnessing the crucifixion. Okay, so after Jesus had finished explaining the Old Testament references to himself, as they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if they were going further, but he urged them strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening, the day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. And when he was at table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. So the simple question may be playing across your minds: how come they didn't recognize Jesus immediately? Well, he could have disguised himself in some way. It could also be that it was a windy day and they all had their headscarves wrapped around them to prevent the dust and sand getting in their mouths. And likewise, when they arrived at the house when they ate, it was getting dark, and the interior would have been lit with simple oil lamps that don't give off much light. Anyway, whatever the reason was, it was only when Jesus broke the bread that they recognized that it was actually Jesus. Can you imagine the excitement they must have felt? They said to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he was speaking to us on the road, while he was explaining the scriptures to us?" Their encounter with Jesus had been really emotional. It had stirred them on the inside. It had moved their very hearts. And once moved, they could not but help share the news. So that very hour, dark though it was, dangerous as the road was, they left to go back to Jerusalem. And they told the disciples there that Jesus was risen, that he had walked with them and talked with them, explained the scriptures to them, and broke bread at their table. And their experience was confirmed, because by the time they got back, Jesus had also already appeared to Peter. And then while they were telling the disciples what had happened, Jesus appears to them, all of them there. Perhaps you have been lucky enough to have had a similar Emmaus Road experience. Perhaps you too have had a similar journey from not recognizing Jesus to understanding what the scripture says about him, to recognizing him for who he is, and finally to telling others what we have experienced. Anyway, so what, Robin? What do we learn from the story? Well, 5 points come to mind. Jesus, the first is Jesus seeks us. The two disciples did not go to Emmaus to look for Jesus. No, it was the other way around. Jesus came looking for them. And exactly the same for us. Jesus is always looking for us, always wanting us to return to him, to put him at the center of our life, to give real meaning to our life. This story is for all of us today. It's for all of us who are firm believers, as it confirms we're on the right road, but it's also a story for the lost. Those of us who perhaps have lost their way a little, those of us for whom the shining light of Jesus doesn't burn as brightly as before, those of us who are not so clear about the meaning of life. Jesus is looking for you. He wants you to come to him in prayer and through his word, in the quiet times, but also in the busy times. He's just waiting for you to say, I want you with me. And he will be there walking beside you on the road of life. The second point is, beware of having the wrong expectations. The Jewish people's expectation for a political Messiah, a governmental savior, to free them from Roman oppression, it created the wrong expectation. The wrong expectation caused many in Jerusalem to lose hope that week after Jesus was crucified. They had a preconceived idea of who Jesus was, what he came to do, and how he should do it. But when things did not turn out the way they thought they should, they dismissed the whole thing as a failure, as misplaced hope and trust. They had the wrong expectation. Now, if there's one key to our personal happiness, it's to do with expectations. Most of our relationships fail because the people concerned do not live up to our expectation. A friend lets us down. Our spouse or partner does or says something that we don't like, and we find it hard to forgive. The trouble is, none of us are perfect. And yet, so often, we expect perfection. So what's the answer? Well, on the everyday level, certainly the more you can reduce the expectations, the more likely you're not to be disappointed. But on the spiritual level, when things do not seem to be working out as planned, surely we need to just let go, let God. Although God has a plan, we're not always privy to that plan. When things don't turn out like we expect, instead of feeling sad, confused, and feeling like giving up, we would be wise to see things differently, to think maybe God is up to something we simply do not understand. Where we should have expectation, the right sort of expectation, is that God will live up to his promises. And the Bible is full of God's promises. One of the most important ones is, if I can find my notes, I seem to have missed out last page. I certainly hope I have my last page here. Sorry? It's on the page. Okay. Thank you. So, surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. Now, number three, Jesus can open our eyes in communion. Why do you think Jesus chose to reveal himself to the two disciples when he was breaking the bread? Surely the main reason is to illustrate the importance of Holy Communion. Why is it so important? Well, firstly, communion is important, but it's a command to remember. Jesus wants us to remember. This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. He wants us to remember that he is the one that provides all we need. In communion, he symbolically gives us the physical food that we need to survive and the spiritual nourishment we need to keep taking our next steps with him. But it's also a time when Jesus can open our eyes, just as he did with Cleopas and his friend. Now you might feel, with some justification, that it's difficult to be in direct communion with Jesus when you're taking communion here at Holy Trinity Cairn. I mean, it's very public, isn't it? A lot of eyes are on us as we're standing here taking communion. But it always used to be standard practice that as soon as you get back to your seat after communion, you prayed. Now, if you don't do that anymore, why don't you start again? Because ironically, the time we close our eyes in prayer can be the very time that Jesus will open our eyes. If something's weighing heavily on your mind, spend that time after receiving communion, giving thanks, taking your communion, taking your problem to God, and listening for answers. Rather than gazing at all the others who are taking communion, use that precious time to let Jesus open our eyes. The fourth point. It's not without significance. It's around the supper table that the disciples' eyes are opened and they see Jesus for who he really is. After the resurrection, several of the appearances of Jesus are associated with table fellowship. When Jesus appears to all the disciples after Cleopas and his friend arrived back in Jerusalem, in order to show them that he's no ghost, Jesus asked them for something to eat. And while they still do not believe it because of joy and amazement, he asked them, "Do you have anything there to eat?" They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. And Jesus again appears to Simon Peter and five other disciples on the shores of Lake Galilee, and this time provides a barbecue for them. We read, Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them and did the same with the fish. Just as he did with the two disciples at Emmaus, Jesus provides the physical and spiritual nourishment that we all need. Jesus only enters the house because Cleopas reaches out hospitably, inviting a seeming stranger in for dinner. In the intimacy of fellowship around the table, Jesus can reveal to himself to us and to others. It's no coincidence that an integral part of the Alpha Course is sharing a meal. It's in the relaxed surroundings of one's home or in a church setting. It's one of the best and most effective ways of sharing the gospel to anyone new in faith. And let us not forget the importance of church lunches. Thanks to Claire Bullman and the catering team, we have the monthly Sunday lunches, which are such an important part of strengthening and consolidating our faith and fellowship here at HTC. And the last and perhaps most important thing from this story is the need to keep our faith alive. Do you remember the beginning of the sermon when I talked about, ask you to think about your first contact with Jesus? When Cleopas and the other disciple heard Jesus explained how he had fulfilled the messianic predictions in the Old Testament, what was their reaction? They asked each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? We all need to go back to the excitement of our first contact with Jesus. And other times when our hearts are on fire. Just thinking about and enjoying those moments are a good first step towards recapturing the emotion we felt at the time. Never lose sight of those moments. Pray more. Read the Bible more. Read about how Christians are doing amazing things for God. Watch Christian films. Find inspirational stories on the net. Do everything you can to keep your heart burning. Keep the smile on your face and the joy in your hearts. So let's finish by singing together that wonderful hymn with the second verse lyrics, "Give me joy in my heart, keep me praising." And mean it. Let's stand and jump and shout.